Okay, so I forget what the title of this talk is, but an alternative and shorter title is simply Holography versus Locality. So let me start by summarizing what is a paraphrase of a weak version of the holographic principle. And that states that the number of degrees of freedom necessary to describe a physical system inside a region of volume V is proportional to its surface area rather than to the volume of the region. And of course, this is closely connected with the Bekenstein bound. In fact, going back a few years, a primary motivation for this proposal came from the black hole information paradox, and the assumption, well, one assumes that the resolution to the black hole information paradox is that black holes obey quantum mechanics. That, in some respects, looks like the easiest way out. And furthermore, that black holes have a number of degrees of freedom, which is actually given by their Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, which is the black hole area up to overall proportionality constants. And directly, as a consequence of this, one can show at least this weak version of the holographic proposal. If you can't put more states than the area inside a black hole, then you can't put more states than, you know, an amount given by the area inside an arbitrary volume. There's a simple argument to that effect. Now, as we all know, that is a very, very non-local proposal. It differs very much from older viewpoints where you have roughly one degree of freedom per cell in, well, per Planck-sized cell, say, in space-time. On the other hand, physics appears to us to be local to a very good approximation. There are a couple of ways of saying this. One is in terms of microscopic tests. Local quantum field theory has been tested quite well and held up to, you know, very high energies, although not on the Planck scale, or not on of Planckian magnitudes, but certainly to very high energies. And furthermore, locality is essential in physics to avoid macroscopic paradoxes. So clearly there's a critical tension between holography and locality, and it would be good to better understand how that tension is resolved, or whether it can be resolved in some realistic holographic theory. So, of course, holography in and of itself is not a theory. It's a proposal for how the world might work. And not long ago, Maldacena gave us a more concrete proposal, a real, well, sort of theoretical framework in which holography would is manifested. And so this is a good place to try to examine these questions. Now, a first question, even before that of locality versus holography, that we might want to investigate is whether Maldacena's correspondence, proposed correspondence, is indeed a complete correspondence, whether you can, say, derive any quantity in string theory on anti-de-Sitter space from conformal field theory on the boundary. For example, can we recover string theory scattering amplitudes in flat space? So that's one question that actually serves as a prelude to the question of whether the conflict between holography and locality gets resolved. You can actually see the resolution here. And of course, we'd like to know, you know, how it is that a theory can be both holographic and look local. And there are, of course, related, slightly more general questions. You could ask the question, do all bulk quantum field theories define boundary conformal field theories in the same manner as the ADS-CFT correspondence? It's likely in some sense they do, and in fact there's been a recent paper arguing this. In some sense it's obvious that you at least get some of the important properties of conformal field theories directly from the properties of quantum field theories, but there may be some other things to iron out. Conversely, you could say, do all boundary conformal field theories give approximately local bulk theories, and the answer to this is almost certainly not. You can certainly imagine, or I would expect you could imagine conformal field theories, say, on the boundary of anti-de Sitter space, that clearly do not have anything resembling bulk locality. And so, given that this, you know, seems quite likely and plausible, at least to me, there is the question of how is it that approximate bulk locality is encoded in the conformal field theory on the boundary?
Do you have an example of this?
Well,
it's terribly hard to find counterexamples because you could have just encoded the information correctly.
The
boundary conformal field theory.
Well, okay, with this type of map, if you say operators on the... with the type of map like GKPW that I'm going to describe later.
Okay,
then that where correlation functions on the boundary are supposed to be mapped in a fairly specific way to certain bulk quantities that we'll talk about.
If you just get an abstract conformal field theory, how do you map that?
Well, again, you could say the map is very much like the Gubser-Klebanoff, Polyakov-Witten map, that it is, you take the same kind of map, and so that's what I have in mind in this context, that you have a map like that, and then you ask, does that give you things that are going to look local in the bulk?
Okay.
And the answer to that has got to be no, but you know, I don't have a concrete example on hand, although...
Any example that's close to perturbation theory.
Right, okay.
Maybe a couple that you said.
Or the exactly soluble models with small numbers, small values of C in two dimensions.
It's got to be the case, I think, that the generic conformal field theory, doesn't have the bulk locality. It's something very special about the conformal field theory we're talking about.
The point above that I don't understand either, because certainly bulk quantum field theories that don't have gravity in them won't have a boundary conformal theory with a stress tensor.
So
it won't be a local field theory in any usual sense. The correlation functions will be conformally invariant that you can define by this map. But they won't satisfy...
You say you won't be able to construct the actual stress tensor.
They will satisfy the Whiteman axiom.
Right.
He knows lots of examples that satisfy the Whiteman axioms that we would not want to consider local quantum field theory. Here's the famous one, due to your problem. Take any quantum field theory. Take a hyperplane in the quantum field theory. Restrict the correlation functions to that hyperplane. They satisfy the Whiteman axiom.
Okay.
So they don't satisfy local conservation laws.
Leaves. Okay, so from that point of view, this statement is not being careful enough about all of the conditions that a conformal field theory should satisfy. You can define correlation functions, as we just said, that obey various axioms, but I guess that's not enough. Okay, so anyway, we'd like to see where bulk locality is, what property it is of this special conformal field theory that we're talking about that encodes bulk locality. So, again, you know, I'm just sort of asking this question as motivation, and then I'm not, you know, the only thing I'm really going to talk about in this talk is the one example we know, namely the ADS CFT correspondence in the traditional sense. So, but
correlation functions to S matrix petals.
Yes. No. Actually, you know, you can write down, say a scalar theory in an ADS background, and there is a map from quantities you compute in there, you know, the generating functional with the appropriate boundary conditions to correlation functions on the boundary. So you can define the map in that sense, but that's presumably not going to have the stress tensor.
What do the green functions of the scalar theory in the ADS background map to on the other side?
So that's a different question. So there is a, given the quantum field theory, you can construct a conformal field theory because, you know, that comes from a particular limit of the Green's functions.
but the on-shell limit.
Yes, yeah, it is essentially an on-shell limit. Then you can ask the question, well, can I go backwards? And it seems pretty clear that in all of this, you can go backwards only to the extent of deriving essentially, you know, things like S matrices, on-shell quantities, not off-shell quantities.
You want to go backwards. You want to go in the same direction.
You mean from quantum field theory?
Why you're not considering off-shell Green functions of the scalar field in curved background, right? And the only rationale I know of is that there's a theory of gravity there.
Yeah, that certainly could be part of the story. I mean, you're saying, I mean, you can say, well, I want to define a conformal field theory, therefore I need to know how to compute correlation functions. This is the definition of correlation functions, the GKPW prescription. But yes, it's true, in a sense, you can, there's more information there in the quantum field theory that you haven't used in that construction, and you might ask, you know, why isn't that manifest in the conformal field theory? Why isn't there something that measures that? And yeah, gravity is certainly part of that story, or quite likely part of that story. So. Okay, so in outline, what I'm going to do is I'm going to review some aspects of the ADS-CFT correspondence with particular focus on the question of how we go from the conformal field theory back to the ADS side, string theory. In particular, I'll talk a little bit about scattering in anti-de Sitter space and its relationship to the conformal field theory. And then I'll go on to discuss the problem of trying to extract the flat space S matrix for string theory from the map. And finally, I'll discuss the question of how we might actually try to test for locality and find it as a property of the conformal field theory. So, of course, the obligatory warning / apology, this is very much work in progress, and there are probably more questions here than answers, but I think they're interesting questions, and I think I have a few things to say about them, so I hope you'll bear with me. Here are some recent references on sort of related work as well as this work. So I've probably left people out. I apologize. Okay, so first, the review of the ADS-CFT correspondence. So, again, Maldacena's proposal was that string theory on, that there is a map between string theory propagating on anti-de Sitter space and n equals 4 SUN supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory on the boundary. This is a conformal field theory, a zero beta function, etc. And this is the relationship between the parameters in the two theories, which most, if not all of you, know by heart by now. Now, my viewpoint in this talk will be to take this, or think of this as a definition of string theory on anti-de Sitter space, namely defining it through this correspondence, and to try to infer whether the resulting definition has the expected properties. Okay, so this is backwards from a lot of the work that's been done in the past year or so, which has been trying to infer properties of Yang-Mills theory from supergravity. And in particular, I'd like to address the question of locality. And I'm actually going to talk about locality in two different ways here. There's sort of the microscopic perspective and the macroscopic perspective. So let me explain what they are. Microscopically, in ordinary field theory, we know that locality is stated by saying that observables commute outside the light cone. Now, this ordinarily in ordinary field theory, this implies macroscopic locality. We know that if you have non-locality in physics, that also leads to acausality, and that allows you to do things like go back in time and kill your grandmother before your mother was born, or send messages back in time, for example. And that clearly leads to paradoxes. And we know that in ordinary field theory, microscopic locality implies macroscopic locality. But in string theory, there's got to be a slightly more complicated story, and I don't think anyone knows the answer to this yet. It's believed that this is, in some sense, violated in string theory, although only weakly at the string scale, because strings are non-local objects. And on the other hand, this had better not be violated in string theory. We'd better not have this kind of paradox appear. You can't use string theory to win the lottery reliably. So so we'd like to, so I'll discuss locality in these two different ways because it's not clear what the connection is in string theory.
In string theory, string field theory, where you ascribe the center of mass position of the string to an operator, is non-local.
Yes.
But it's not a causal.
Well, is that true? There's... Okay, and, all right. Well, but on the other hand, there have been arguments made by people in this room. How does that... I mean, certainly in the paper with Lowe and Susskind, you argued that commutators don't vanish outside the light cone, if I recall.
We'll never figure out if it's a gauge artifact or not.
Okay, so... Okay. That's right. So... this question is not completely settled, certainly, in string theory, how, you know, what the connection is. But
if you were to recover strict field theoretical locality, mm-hmm. maybe you could see a deep correspondence that might lead us to be unhappy about it.
By string theoretic locality, you mean...
Strict, yes.
That would lead us to be unhappy, yes. It should be approximate. Okay, so I'll sort of talk about things from these two perspectives, and the bottom line is I'm not sure exactly how a locality should be formulated in string theory.
Isn't the modern point of view sort of that you're not allowed to ask questions like that because you're off-shell string theory?
Well, that certainly could be... Well, I'll come back to that question, okay? I'll come back to that indirectly when I talk about how we should discuss locality. Okay, so, certainly you're allowed to ask questions like, can I send a message back in time instructing someone to kill my grandmother, right? I mean, that... Yes, I presume that can... I presume there is some suitable formulation, but maybe not, since it leads to inconsistency, perhaps not. But anyway, let's postpone such philosophical discussions for later. Okay, so the first question in this business is how do we recover string theory? And so let's first go over quickly some of the basics that people already know. First of all, from the point of view of kinematics, we know how you map back and forth. For example, the component fields of string theory in the bulk map onto operators in the conformal field theory. The metric goes to the stress tensor, the dilaton to trace F squared, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, at this level, the first question you could ask is, do you get the correct number of states from this map? For example, well, here we have a five-dimensional theory. Here we have a four-dimensional theory. How, at the naive level, are you even matching the counting of states between the two? The answer to this is, relatively simple. Namely, think about one dilaton states. So those are parameterized by, say, their momentum and their frequency in, say, Poincaré coordinates. And they obey a Machel condition. And as a result of that, there are four free parameters in anti-de Sitter space. And then over on this side, you can, say, take the Fourier transform of an operator corresponding to the dilaton, okay, this operator. And that actually also depends on four free variables because it doesn't satisfy a Machel condition. So you can match things up. You can match up the states one-to-one. And as we know, there's been lots more work done on this state matching, including the S5 harmonics and so on, and it all works quite beautifully. Although this does raise still a little bit of a puzzle, if you think about it, it looks like the number of states we're talking about goes like that of ordinary quantum field theory on anti-de Sitter space, So you might say, how does holography work? Part of the story is that the boundary theory is a conformal theory, and so it has, in a sense, an infinite number of degrees of freedom. It has degrees of freedom at all possible masses because there's no mass scale. One precise way of saying this is to look at the Kalman-Lehmann representation of the two-point function, and you see that you have, that the density there has non-zero support at all possible values of the mass. So that's part of the story, but more generally we should first of all regulate this and not talk about comparing infinity to infinity, and also we should include interactions. And of course Susskind and Witten have talked about the situation in that case. If you put an ultraviolet cutoff in the field theory and count the number of degrees of freedom, you get something that precisely agrees with the Bekenstein band. You might have objected that in anti-de Sitter space the area and the volume are proportional, but they do have different R dependence, so this should serve as a non-trivial check that you're sort of counting states the way, well, in a sensible way, and that that this is really behaving sort of holographically and everything matches up. I think there's still some open questions to sort out there, but let me not dwell on those. Okay, so that's at the level of counting states. Let's go on to discuss dynamics, interactions in particular. And a priori, even though the states match up between the two theories, a priori the bulk theory that is defined by the conformal field theory could be arbitrarily non-local. There's no clear reason at the outset why that isn't true. And so again, we're after the dynamical property of the conformal field theory that leads to approximate bulk locality, and in order to discuss that we need a map between fundamental processes involving string theory and anti-de Sitter space and between the conformal field theory. So let me just refresh your memories about a few of the facts here. So here's a picture of anti-de Sitter space. I'm going to be using the global coordinates. Global time goes up, and then the global radial variable I'll call rho. Rho equals pi over 2 is really at infinite distance, but we, of course, picture it as being at finite distance. The conformal field theory is, in a sense, defined out at rho equals pi over 2, although we know there are subtleties in that as well. And then you have some stringy process in here that you would like to map into conformal field theory data. Again, the metric takes this form, which everyone should be familiar with. You see manifestly the infinite distance at the boundary because cos rho is blowing up there. And this is the line element on the 3-sphere. So just a quick review of that. In order to discuss dynamics, it's useful to think about the behavior of the modes, free modes on anti-de Sitter space. So I'll start by discussing that. Let's suppose we truncate string theory down to just one of its component scalar fields, and for the moment neglect interactions, which we'll talk about later. How do the modes behave? Well, so we're solving the Klein-Gordon equation, and we can use the symmetries time translation and rotation to write down separated solutions in terms of plane waves, spherical harmonics, and radial wave functions. And these radial wave functions are determined by an effective radial potential that you get from the Klein-Gordon equation. And that effective radial potential looks like this. Is a function of rho. It blows up at rho equals pi over 2. And of course you have a regularity condition at the origin. So we know exactly what kind of behavior to expect for these radial wave functions in this potential. If you look at them at a generic frequency, you're going to have something that oscillates in the allowed region and then will exponentially grow in the forbidden region. And it's only for very special frequencies that you get something that dies down exponentially in the forbidden region. The details of this are parameterized by these very important parameters, 2H plus and minus, which are given in terms of the dimension. I'm talking about ADS D plus 1. and by the mass, by that formula. So specifically at generic frequencies, as you go to rho equals pi over 2 to the boundary of anti-de Sitter space, this solution blows up like cos rho to the 2h minus. 2h minus is negative. So these are non-normalizable solutions. And it's only for these specific frequencies given by this formula in terms of this 2h plus, which also is related to the conformal weight, only for these discrete frequencies do you get normalizable behavior cos rho to the 2h plus as you go off to infinity in anti-de Sitter space. So normalizable solutions. And this whole sort of picture suggests sort of a paradigm for thinking about anti-de Sitter space, which is partially useful but partially misleading. And that is to picture anti-de Sitter space as a resonant cavity with a certain spectrum of normal modes. So again, there are important differences which we'll see shortly. Okay, so now how do we map from conformal field theory to string theory? Well, of course, there's this map that we have seen that we all know about. It was proposed by these guys. And it states that the string partition function with specific behavior, specific boundary conditions, namely that the fields go to, well, up to possibly infinite proportionality factors, go to some specified function as you go off to the boundary of anti-de Sitter space. This partition function is supposed to be equal to the conformal field theory correlator, where now these boundary values behave as sources in the boundary theory. So again, I'm taking this as a definition of a certain kind of generating function in string theory, and we'd like to ask the question, well, what is the physical interpretation of this object in the context of string theory? So in order to answer that question, let's suppose for the moment, hypothetically, that we knew the bulk theory and ask, if we knew the bulk theory, what kind of object would we be computing here? So, for example, if we think about the four-point function, the GKPW map becomes the statement that the four-point function in the conformal field theory is given by a Feynman diagram, the full four-point function in the bulk, where you truncate the external propagators here and replace them by the bulk boundary propagators. And the bulk boundary propagators can be gotten as just a limit of the ordinary the ordinary two-point function in the bulk. The two-point function vanishes as you go out to the boundary, so you compensate for that by scaling with this factor, and that's how you get the full bulk boundary propagator. So you tack those on instead of the ordinary propagators, and that's what gives you the four-point functions in the conformal field theory. At tree level, just one other statement that will be important later, at tree level, these bulk boundary propagators are, of course, solutions of the free equations. They're solutions that go over to essentially delta functions as the bulk point x prime here approaches the boundary point b here. Okay, so the first question to ask is, what physics does this kind of thing describe in the context of string theory? And the answer to that, that was discussed in a couple of earlier papers, and the basic picture is that this is an ADS analog of the S matrix. So let's first refresh our memories why you can't define an S matrix. Well, let's refresh our memories what the story is with the S matrix in anti-de Sitter space. So usually we define an S matrix by, roughly speaking, to paraphrase, taking some endpoint function and taking its external points off to the infinite far future or past, and that has the effect of projecting the external lines to be on shell, and that's how you get out an S matrix. Of course, you know, there are all the details of LSZ, which that gives short shrift to, but that's the rough idea. And you could ask yourself the question, can I do this in anti-de Sitter space? And the answer is no. If you here, it's very important that asymptotically these things look like, one particle states that are free, and sort of all of the interactions are taking place here. In anti-de Sitter space, you don't have that asymptotic separation. If you, say, have a pair of particles come in and collide at a certain time, well, because of the confining potential of anti-de Sitter space, the particles will go out and asymptotically separate for a while, but then they'll come back in, they'll bounce off the potential and come back in and interact again and again and again and again. So you can't asymptotically separate them just by going to the far past and future. So that presents a bit of an obstacle, but the picture I just drew suggests what the answer to this question is. I've drawn a similar picture again. The answer is that what we want to do if we want to compute an analog of a scattering amplitude in anti-de Sitter space is we want to take the states not to temporal infinities, but take the states off, or the external points off to spatial infinity. And that has the effect, again, of projecting them on shell. And this looks just like the GKPW prescription. And so, in other words, what we're learning is that this GKPW prescription is giving us an anti-de Sitter analog of the S matrix, which is called which I call SDEL, the boundary S matrix. And this is the relation between the boundary S matrix and the conformal field theory correlation function, say, if we're working in terms of frequency space and angular momentum. Okay, so there are more details that could be supplied to this, but this is, those details are probably not relevant to what I'm going to say. Okay, but the basic message is that the conformal field theory correlation functions correspond to a type of to a close analog of scattering. You could ask questions about unitarity of this thing and so on and so forth, but I'm not sure if they're germane for the subsequent developments of the talk. Okay, so in particular, what we'd like to do, as I said, is investigate locality, now that we have some understanding of what kind of physics these things are describing, what kinds of physical processes. And yeah.
This applies to massive particles in the interior as well as massless particles.
Yes.
So how does a massive particle get to the
boundary? Neither the massive nor the massless really make it to the boundary without some suppression. Okay. And so what you have, that's exactly what these factors are in the bulk boundary propagator. They're telling you that, let me show another slide since you asked this question. How to think of the boundary S matrix. Okay, so what you want to do is you want to build the ADSLC. Here is the diagram for it. So you stick a LINAC out here and a LINAC out here and then collide stuff in the middle and then goes off to a detector. Now, of course, the problem is there is an exponent. The further out this sort of source sits, the more suppressed the amplitude will be in the middle. So you have to take that LINAC and you have to have a dial on it where you can turn up the amplitude or the luminosity, whatever, as you take it out to infinity, and you have to consider that limit. So that's. Well, there are other ways of thinking about this, but that's
the LINACs in your construction are not positioned at definite time. They are positioned at definite what?
You could position them at, you could have a definite run time that you turn them on for and turn them off and so on. They could be more or less like ordinary LINACs, except their anti-de Sitter spaces. They'd be very hard to get out to the boundary of anti-de Sitter space. That would take some real work. So to speak. So So. Okay. So, but what? Okay, what we'd like to do is really, we're not so interested in what goes on in anti-de Sitter space. We want to know what goes on in flat space. In particular, we want to investigate locality, and to do so, we have to really take the large radius limit of anti-de Sitter space to sort of get away from the effects of this confining potential of anti-de Sitter space and allow us to nicely separate wave packets, at least for a very long time. Okay, so my naive expectation at the beginning, or well, earlier when I was thinking about the definition of the boundary S matrix, was that in the R goes to infinity limit for anti-de Sitter space, that the boundary S matrix just goes over into the Minkowski S matrix, and that is that. And this expectation, well, as we'll see, is not completely correct. Let's first, well, talk about how you actually take this limit. So here again is the line element for anti-de Sitter space, and the way that you see that you have approximately Minkowski space in certain regions of it is to make this redefinition of coordinates. And if you do that and work in the limit where little r is much, much less than big R, then it's easy to see this goes straight over into the Minkowski line element in spherical polar coordinates. You're effectively scaling out this r by the redefinition of tau and rho, and then cos squared rho will be small in this limit, and sine squared rho will be r squared over big R squared, and so that's what you get. So this is the, so you see an approximately flat metric out to a scale, out to a radius comparable to the S radius, which is exactly what you expect. Also, of course, this tells you what the map is between the variables that you discuss in anti-de Sitter space, the momentum variables, and those of flat space. There's just a simple rescaling of the energy, and the angular momentum is the same. Okay, so this is the picture. Here's anti-de Sitter space, and then here is one very large, from the point of view of real size, one very large region of anti-de Sitter space that looks approximately flat. Okay, and again, it's at rho much, much less than 1, so in these coordinates, it looks quite tiny. And if we want to discuss scattering in approximately flat space, clearly we have to discuss processes that are taking place in that region to avoid the effects of the long-distance anti-de Sitter potential.
Can you do that with any of the Mitten eigenstates, or do you have to superpose them?
Well, I'm not sure how... ask me that later. Ask me that later. Okay. So this is what we want to do. Okay, now it turns out... okay, so we'd like to do that, but that's hard for a couple of reasons, or at least non-trivial. Here is a rough picture of one of the reasons. Okay, there are a lot of those regions, and they get smaller and smaller as you go to the boundary. Anti-de Sitter space has a lot more volume at infinity than ordinary flat space. Okay, so this is much worse than flat space, whoops, out there at infinity. So that's part of the story. Let's look at the details a little bit more. So let's now think about putting in interactions. And here, well, let's think about just a phi cubed theory. And think about one simple diagram, a four-point function in that theory. And let's think about one contribution to that, well, one contribution to that four-point function, just this diagram. And that diagram is, in terms of formulas, well, just given by this, where we have the Feynman propagator propagating from x to x prime, and then bulk boundary propagators taking these out to the boundary. Okay, now we could, at this point, ask the question, okay, here is a contribution to a correlation function on the boundary. How do we extract from that the corresponding flat space S matrix? And we know what that is. It's 1 over the Mandelstam parameter T. Okay? So is there some simple way to go directly from this expression to the flat space S matrix, a prescription that we could apply in a situation where we didn't have this picture to fill in, where we didn't actually know the field theory in the book? We're trying to deduce its S matrix elements. And there's actually a problem here in trying to get the flat space S matrix, and that is the following. If you look at, let's Fourier transform, let's go over to frequency space and look at generic frequencies for these states on the boundary. At generic frequencies, we're looking at the bulk boundary propagator. I said it's a solution of the equations of motion in the bulk, and if we're on a specific frequency, then therefore it must grow like cos rho to the 2h minus for a generic frequency, because that's what all solutions do, unless you're at one of the discrete frequencies that we talked about. Okay, so that grows, that blows up at the boundary. Likewise, there was this fact pictured in the picture that I just showed, that the volume gets very big at infinity in anti-de Sitter space as well. So when you come up here and look at where the integral over x, where the meat comes from in that, so to speak, you have this factor that's growing quite rapidly at the boundary and this factor that's growing quite rapidly at the boundary. And combined, they tell you that you don't have anything, the integral does not have support just in some little region here. It has support that's actually dominated out near the boundary. Okay, so this tells you that there's some real serious difficulty in focusing into these Minkowski regions. And this actually holds even if you build wave packets, it turns out. Yes?
I disagree. I mean, you had such a nice picture with the Linux. You're saying you can't build those Linux?
Well, okay, I'm going to give a prescription that I think partly works, but it's a hard thing to do. You have to confine yourself to the normalizable nodes.
Suppose I'm building a Linac here.
Yes.
Think about the experimentalists. They are not repeating themselves every de Sitter time.
Yeah.
They are doing whatever they
Well, do. R is big, so we don't know.
They're using non-normalizable frequencies. So why can't they build a Linac?
I don't know a... answer to that.
I think it's a non-problem. Well, they may be smart enough to avoid. I mean, they always have. This is the kind of thing experimentalists are good at. They usually have to really want to.
I think that they really are made at. Well, I think part of the story. Well, I'm not sure what the answer to that is in those terms. But I think that you. I don't think it's possible to do this with the non-normalizable modes. Let me give you an example taken from a famous paper. Oh, wait, go ahead.
Build the Linac, but given what's coming out of the Linac, it's hard to compute what the in state is for the Euclidean for the flat space S matrix.
Actually, let me state it another way. We can build those Linacs, okay? We can build those Linacs, but if we allow them to include non-normalizable modes, then we can't focus the beams.
They must again. The experimentalists are not repeating themselves every de Sitter.
No. Let's suppose
they're using, in your language, non-normalizable modes.
Right, but the question is how you focus the beam, so to speak, into the Well, okay. A very clever guy I know by the name of Polchinski tried to do this.
Not as clever as an experimentalist, but we'll get to that.
Okay. So if you want to see what happens in that case.
Is this the optimal strategy for the seminar? You could just argue with himself.
Yeah, just cut myself out of the loop. Okay, so Joe tried to do this, and he was looking at the m equals 0 case, where 2h plus and minus are d and 0. Okay? And so he was trying to build wave packets out of solutions, and these wave packets, the wave packets that he wrote down, as rho goes to pi over 2, they are independent of rho, corresponding to the fact that h minus is 0. Okay, so they look just like this. And he said, well, okay, why not use those? Why don't our clever experimentalists use those? And so let's write down the formula I just wrote down where we stick in the wave packets. So here we have one of these wave packets and here another. And here, say, the bulk propagator. And let's take rho goes to pi over 2. And here we have something that goes like rho minus pi over 2 to the d plus 1 in the denominator. Here we have something that goes to a constant as rho goes to infinity, and it's a small constant sort of out here away from some particular angle, but it still has non-zero support. Okay, so these go to constants. Here we have something that dies as rho goes to pi over 2, and we know exactly how it dies. It dies like cos rho to the 2h plus, which is normalizable behavior. So you add up all the rho behavior, and you get a net logarithmic divergence. And it's not, again, if you have a, you know, something like an exponential here, that logarithmic divergence will be sort of caught in the tails of the
right. This, that's because this is the wave packet. The wave packet, the Gaussian doesn't go exactly to zero.
Yes.
But the slack being really is zero outside the beam tube. I mean, you're worried about interaction with something that tunnels through the beam tube and goes sideways in ABS space and interacts with another particle that tunnels through a beam tube and went sideways in ABS space.
I think we have to be careful about our intuition, because basically if you put a source on the boundary of anti-de Sitter space, if you have, say, a point source, you might... Well, if you have a point source, it has non-zero support to have particles sort of propagating along the boundary. The whole, the bulk boundary Green's function is the result of a point source, and it diverges on the boundary as well as on the light cone inside. And so now you say, can I sort of smear this out in some way, or can I, you know, restrict it so that I don't have this behavior where things are sort of diverging at infinity? And I certainly don't see how to do that, and I think I have what's close to a theorem that you can't, but... Okay, but we'd have to discuss that.
I'm sorry, mathematically, Joe, are you claiming that if you, instead of the Gaussian, you took a wave function with compact support, that this would go away?
Yeah, sure. I can't speak to that calculation.
I mean, why is there a controversy here if that's all it is?
You could take a function with compact support here, for example, but that... I mean, this is a point-like source. That's a source that's just sort of smeared out with some characteristic size. The point-like source, clearly you have the problem still.
And this emerges as a simple image in the gauge theory. So if you're calculating correlation function with some region where two operators come together, I mean, you cut that out. It's not hard. It's suppose I just take the same correlation with a small circle cut out.
Well.
It removes the divergence in the end. This wave overlap, the Gaussian wave packets is order e to the minus root n, because those are narrow Gaussians.
Let me see. Actually, e to the minus 1 over root n.
That omega is n to the 1 half per quarter. So okay.
Yeah, that's true, but there's still a divergence here. So, I'd be interested in trying to figure out if there is a way of doing this, but I have not yet been able to figure out one, and I've sort of been trying to figure out how to do it. Yes?
I don't understand. I'm sorry that I'm pressing this point, but it seems to me that you're claiming that if instead of that formula up there, I just said f is some function of compact support,
Right.
The problem is the following.
Things are a little less well behaved in momentum space, and
Here's a way of rephrasing.
It's not completely obvious.
Here's a way of rephrasing what you want. Okay, you want a source on the boundary, right? Say smeared out over some region. And you want that to have compact support in the sense that you have this source on the boundary and then you have a beam of compact support in here that doesn't blow up at infinity. Uh-huh. And okay. I think it's hard to construct these.
And you said that's not obviously something that you can do. You really
right.
have to solve the wave equation with that source.
Right. That's the problem. So you can't, it's hard to focus if you allow these non-normalizable modes to play in the game. So, that's, yes?
Just a bit of a question. The main argument that the volume is far bigger outside, if you look at the bulk-to-bulk propagator, I mean, that may be like bigger range when x and x prime are close in
the region. No, when x and x prime are close, the bulk-to-bulk propagator goes over into the standard Feynman propagator. And when they're far apart, then you have...
Only when they're close.
When they're close as compared to R.
Right. close any of the center or close enough?
No, they, as long as, well, okay, you can make any point near the center by an SOD comma 2 transformation. So this is a universal statement. Okay, so this is part of the problem. Okay, so the claim is that you can't, at least I can't see how to focus these things even if you build wave packets. Maybe a clever experimentalist, or better yet, Joe, will come along and tell me how to do this. So it looks to me like you're dominated by the interactions out here, and in a sense, if you work at these generic frequencies, holography is only, well, maybe this isn't the best way of saying it, but it's only sort of skin deep. It doesn't see down to the core of anti-de Sitter space. And this is where we run into a contrast with our resonant cavity intuition. Okay, now there's an obvious proposed resolution to this, and that is to project on normalizable states. And so we don't have this sort of nasty behavior at infinity. And so how would we do that? Well, let's look at the bulk boundary propagator at an arbitrary frequency, and then take that frequency to one of these discrete frequencies. This has a pole at that frequency, so if we want to really find anything sensible, we have to eliminate that divergence, or in other words, pick out the residue at the pole. So this prescription gives something that is normalizable. It goes like cos rho to the 2h plus at infinity. And so this leads to a proposal. Well, one way of saying it is we can make our wave packets only out of these modes. Okay? And if we make our wave packets only out of these modes, then we can build things, I believe, that have this kind of compact support and proceed and be happy. And in fact, we can propose a definition now for the flat space S matrix using this exactly this kind of prescription. We take the correlation functions, we Fourier transform them, then we take the limit where we go to these discrete frequencies, and that gives us the S matrix in the in energy, say, in angular momentum variables. Okay. I mean, there's the usual broadening of flat space, but they're all, yeah, I guess there could, but I haven't looked at the details of the broadening of the, the frequencies, yeah, they're spaced in units of roughly 1 over R, so as R gets big, you get something that goes over into some, you know, very close to a continuum, so that's a perfectly sensible thing to use. It's like working in a box, right, from that point of view, if you use the normalizable guys. You could build NLC in a very big box. As a matter of fact, we could all live in a very big box that is, you know, however many billion light years across. Okay, so this is a proposal, but it suffers a potential difficulty, and that is if you're using some kind of approximation scheme to calculate the correlators on the boundary, generically these frequencies are going to receive corrections order by order and perturbation in whatever your perturbation scheme is, or non-perturbatively. And also, at higher loop level, you could have more complicated analytic dependence in the frequency. So you have to sit exactly on these frequencies to eliminate the contamination from the non-normalizable behavior. And you have to be, well, it's not clear that you can sit exactly on those the way you would like. There may be an order-by-order way to do this, but again, well, that remains to be seen. It's a potential difficulty, so this is not yet a complete prescription, in my opinion. Okay. Nonetheless, let's assume that this problem can be resolved and go on to the next question. Now we've got a definition of the S matrix. What can we learn about locality? So the conformal field theory data only specifies an S matrix in this game. At least that is widely believed, and I think that's been exhibited, at least in terms of the conformal field theory data we've been talking about here. You don't get any off-shell information, and this is expected from two points of view. Two related points of view. One is, of course, holography, and it's connected to this statement about relating on-shell momenta to arbitrary momentum on the boundary. since time is short, let me not dwell on that. Another point of view is that of gauge invariance, and you don't expect to have off-shell gauge invariant observables in, say, string theory. So, so you've got to ask your questions in terms of the S matrix. We've got to figure out a way of diagnosing locality or its breakdown directly from the S matrix. Now, I don't know a complete answer about how to do this. And in fact, I'd be very interested if anyone can tell me more than I know. Maybe some of you do have some more knowledge on this. But let me tell you some of the pieces of this that I know. So first of all, sort of at the taking the microscopic point of view, one way of testing locality in the S matrix is to set bounds on the momentum dependence of the S matrix at large center of mass momentum, say at fixed momentum transfer or angle. If you work with local theories that have a mass gap and you take S goes to infinity at fixed angle, you can derive various bounds. The four-point function can't grow too fast, and it has to. It's also bounded below. These are consequences both of the locality as well as various other assumptions like analyticity and so on. But locality definitely plays a role. For example, if you try to generalize to theories that have non-locality, and this problem has been of deriving these bounds has been studied in sort of models for a theory called theories called quasi-localizable theories. These are theories also with a mass gap and with a spectrum that looks like this. It exponentially grows in energy. These theories are, of course, of interest because a special case of this kind of behavior is what we see in string theory. So these give propagators that have non-local, well, they have singularities at sort of distance scales of order L. They give non-local behavior, and people have derived bounds like these in these quasi-localizable theories and found that the bound depends on the form of the non-locality. Okay, so that suggests that indeed these kinds of bounds are sensitive to how non-local the theory is. This is actually a slightly weaker bound. This is a Greenberg-Lowe type bound rather than the Froissart. This suggests that we could, if we have behavior that comes anywhere near to saturating these bounds, actually diagnose how non-local a theory is from the growth of its amplitude. Okay, there are probably better ways of saying this, but I don't know what they are.
So you gave in the course some bounds from many years ago. I don't remember exactly where the locality. I remember the ingredient of unitarity.
Yes.
I remember the ingredient of the potential, mm-hmm. the partial waves having a certain type of behavior, which was exponentially damped and mm-hmm. not more than power like by S.
Yeah, it's the power like by S is where the locality comes into it.
If you remember in more detail where.
Well, basically, you are assuming polynomial boundedness in S. And if, for example, this kind of thing manifestly violates that, it leads to propagators that don't have that behavior. So at least certain kinds of non-locality.
I'm not sure exactly what the relevance of Poisson is, because that we know is violated in gravity just because of, graviton exchange of large energy.
What?
Let
me get back to that. That's probably a property more from the masslessness, I would guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me get back. Okay.
Well,
so this, I'm talking. Okay. Let me. Okay. One more thing to say. Okay. Yeah. Let me go on to my next slide. That's a good lead into my next slide. Thank you, Tom. So there are ways of diagnosing locality or its lack thereof in these various bounds. But gravity is a little trickier, okay, as Tom is just pointing out. In fact, derivation of these bounds fails if you don't have a mass gap, which we don't in gravity. In fact, we don't have an S matrix either. We have to, for example, consider certain inclusive amplitudes. You might ask the question whether you could derive similar bounds on inclusive amplitudes. I don't know if anyone has looked at that question in the distant past, but they're presumably.
Depends on how many non-compact dimensions there are.
Right.
No S matrix in four dimensions.
Yeah, and flats.
Five or more in flat space.
Right. Five or more in flat space.
There is an S matrix.
There is an S matrix. Oh, the infrared divergences go away then? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I hadn't. Okay. Anyway. Okay. So maybe there is some generalization we could. Well, there's an interesting set of questions about how to generalize these types of bounds to theories with gravity. On the other hand, we do have some knowledge, we have some stringy expectations about the large S behavior of string theory that have, you know, going back to work of Gross and Mende, and actually this formula is a Borel resummation due to Mende and Aguri. Okay, so we have some expectation about how this should behave, and this encodes sort of the right amount of non-locality for string theory, and the question is this something we could get from the, you know, ultimately from the conformal field theory, see sort of the origins of the right kind of behavior. Yes, Michael.
Maybe there's sort of a comment to make about the bounds on the total cross-section.
Mm-hmm.
Those don't necessarily apply order by order perturbation theories.
Okay.
In QCD, for example, the...
Right.
So in perturbation theory,
yes,
cross-sections with some kind of inclusive finite cross-sections,
mm-hmm,
are, asymptotically constant times logarithms, but then
okay,
if you add up certain classes of graphs that were identified by Lepotov, you get S to a power.
Okay, right.
And the thought is that there's some even higher approximation where you take sums over those ladders that it goes down in respect.
And it's what you want, yeah. Yeah, so this of course would be a subtle question of getting this out of any, you know, if someone handed you the stone tablets with the conformal field theory correlation functions inscribed on them, that would be great, but in any calculational scheme that may be hard. Yes, that's, yeah, and of course it's worth pointing out that the approximation scheme you could be using in conformal field theory may not be order by order and usual perturbation in the book, so yeah, could be a slightly different story.
I think I should also mention that I think there are fairly good arguments that these perturbative results are not the correct asymptotic energy.
They're not the whole story, and I think you're right, and in fact, you know, there are various issues like, you know, pair production of D0 brains and various other things that, you know, non-perturbative
so
issues that correct
this.
So
this is valid in a range of F that's asymptotically large compared to alpha prime, but smaller than scales that are alpha prime over G to some point.
Right. Yeah, so exactly. So this, maybe this should be put in quotes or I should put some limits, but anyway, we have some knowledge. We don't have complete knowledge about the large S behavior of string theory.
Looks like these estimations are not reliable.
That I didn't know
what
about.
What I remember happening there is that Gross and Mende, first of all, it's large S, Mende, it's not fixed.
Yeah, there's a fixed angle, if I believe.
You can ask for fixed order perturbation theory, what is the large S and T behavior. That's what Gross and Mende did.
Yeah.
Then you can take this result and try to resum it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Gross and Mende, sorry, Mende and Mende did. However,
right,
then you can also ask where is the, what you're getting coming from. And it was coming from orders and perturbation theory where the cross amended approximation was not valid.
Okay, I didn't realize. Is that published somewhere, the objection?
It's
or
published in those papers.
Well, okay, but okay, you have to.
You just
all right.
I mean,
you can look and see what the.
Was,
okay, you have to check it.
There is a regime in which the cross amended result is correct. Okay. If G is asymptotically small and S is S and T are asymptotically large compared to alpha prime, then the Grossman and the S is not of order 1 over D to the bound.
No, that's
the Grossman day is fine.
I thought that this was what Mende and Aguri were trying to show, and it wasn't true. Because, well, I guess it was taking up time.
Let me see.
There's a question about cookies, right?
Yeah, it's almost cookie. It's almost cookie time. I don't want to deprive anyone of cookies. I have four or five more transparencies.
Like,
so
if it's more than like 20 minutes, we should stop. And if it's less, I think we should.
Well, it's hard to anticipate the time taken by questions. I think that if I just say what I have to say, it can be said in probably less than 10 minutes.
Well, I mean,
There's another seminar in this room at 3:30.
Oh, okay. So I'll, maybe I should barge on ahead. Okay, I will barge on ahead. Okay, so microscopic tests, macroscopic tests. Okay, so we don't, on a macroscopic level, I don't know what it is in string theory that says you can't go back in time and kill your grandmother. But here is some proposal for how to discuss sort of locality at a more macroscopic level. Okay, first of all, we know, roughly speaking, it says we shouldn't be able to communicate outside the light cone at large scales. Okay, that, of course, has to be quantified. One criterion for this is that you have potentials between at least objects that don't have, say, non-abelian charges, that don't, or that fall off at least as rapidly as Coulomb potentials at infinity. Now, in our particular example here, we want large radii as compared to one in string units, but we want to be thinking about things at small radii as compared to the ADS radius, which we're taking to be big. And so one criterion for locality is to say that, say you fix S, and in terms of momentum space, fix S and look at decreasing T, but not too small, and you should have an amplitude that is falling off like 1 over T or more rapidly, but not, or sorry, it's blowing up like 1 over, well, it's not blowing up faster than this. It's bounded above by 1 over T. Okay, so we should certainly have this kind of behavior in the regime of fixed S and small T, at least between these bounds. More generally, we should recover, of course, the whole structure of semi-classical gravity at large radius and small T. And so this is one criterion we could investigate and ask how we see in the conformal field theory. And you might ask whether this is encoded somehow in the operator product expansion. I've looked a little at that. One way of seeing that it might be is if you, say, take these two boundary points close together, then effectively you're going to be pulling out the point where this interaction wants to sit out towards the boundary. And so you might say, well, I go to the limit where these things are very close together, and I'm looking at the very long distance properties of this propagator, and I should see this fall off. Okay? So you can try that. And in fact, the fall off of this propagator is determined by the dimension of the exchanged field. So you can relate the how fast it falls off to the dimensions of the corresponding fields in the conformal field theory. But the problem is with that is that really we want the fall off, as I said, in order to investigate sort of flat space locality, we want the fall off in this small region here, okay, in the purple region. In other words, we want to see this fall off behavior at radii that are much, much less than big R. Okay, we want to see the falloff in this domain. And we can't really see that from this approach. As you pull these out, you're not sort of localizing this interaction point within this region. You're just discovering the falloff at very large distances as compared to the ADS radius. You're checking locality at long distances, but not at distances less than or of order R, big R. Again, because of this averaging behavior of the that we saw in the four-point function, that it that you get contributions from lots of different places in anti-de Sitter space, and it's hard to sort of focus into this small region. Okay, so you could actually take this one step further and ask, what is it in conformal field theory that can actually resolve shorter scales? Suppose, for example, we have a bulk source. Again, in a hypothetical field theory, suppose you have a bulk source with some characteristic scale, and you might ask, are there any measurements that are sensitive to the size of that source? And, for example, you might look at two-point functions or at one-point functions. And another way of seeing that there's generically some difficulty in doing so is to just look at for example, this situation where we have a bulk source at a point and look at how the one-point function depends on the location of that point. This is just given by the bulk boundary propagator, which is written here, and if we look at how the bulk boundary propagator varies as we, say, vary the bulk source over, you know, some finite distance but small as compared to the ADS radius, we pull out a 1 over the ADS radius here, so we get a very small variation. The bulk propagator is very insensitive to where this source is or how big this source is in, you know, a single Minkowski region. So again, really to sort of probe on the level of distance necessary, we need to presumably do something like construct very sharp looking wave packets. Okay, so this suggests that only locality on scales bigger than the ADS radius is readily accessible from the conformal field theory. Again, that the locality on those scales is presumably related to the spectrum. And leaves us with the question, what property is it that ensures locality on shorter distance scales? And for the pessimists in the audience, to keep them happy, if pessimists could be kept happy, you might even ask the question, you know, does bulk locality fail? Could it fail in the ADS CFT core, you know, in this definition, attempted definition of string theory at scale short as compared to the ADS scale? So I think that's a valid question at this point. I think the answer is, well, let me not say what I think about that. Now, of course, there have been previous suggestions about what the origin of bulk locality is in the conformal field theory, and these include sort of large N factorization and scale locality. And these probably have something to do with the story, but again, you could ask the question, you know, are these telling you that the theory behaves like it's local on scales of the ADS radius or on scales of the string scale? And I don't know. Finally, this is my last slide before my conclusion. After Michael's talk yesterday, I realized that another way of investigating whether you get supergravity at large distances and it behaves in the sort of approximately local fashion you want is to, you know, look at motion of three brains in anti-de Sitter space, and presumably some calculations like this where you have graviton exchange, presumably those, you can see evidence for locality if you can do these calculations, and it's probably related to some of the stuff he was saying, although I don't know exactly how. Okay, so that's another place you could investigate this. And so let me finish by summarizing. So I've told you that the ADS-CFT correspondence provides a concrete framework to investigate this tension between holography and locality. You knew this. Okay. The conformal field theory correlators, I've said, determine an analog of the S matrix for anti-de Sitter space. Okay, they're related to scattering. The naive R goes to infinity limit, large radius limit of this, looks like it depends on physics in infinitely many approximately flat regions. It sort of gets smeared out. And it's only possible, so far as I can see, to extract the flat space S matrix in a single region through a very delicate projection onto normalizable states. I've talked about once you get this S matrix, how you might probe whether it is behaving in an approximately local fashion, and the obvious thing is to look at bounds on the four-point function, either sort of in the microscopic sense, looking at large S and fixed T or theta, or even at the macroscopic level, fixing S and looking at small t. And there, of course, you should not only discover some characteristic falloff, but you should really discover more of the details of semi-classical gravity. Then finally, I've said that you can see in outline how you might derive scales or locality on scales comparable to the anti-de Sitter radius, but on shorter scales, I think it's an a bit of a mystery how this emerges. So open questions, of course, one open question is how to better, a better prescription for extracting the flat space S matrix, or prescription that shows you that you can avoid, you know, problems with corrections in the locations of these discrete frequencies. We would like, of course, a better understanding of how locality is encoded in S matrices. How do you discuss locality bounds, for example, in gravity and theories without a gap? And then finally, we'd like to, this big question, we'd like to see concretely how we find approximate bulk locality in the ADS-CFT correspondence on scales small as compared to the anti-de Sitter radius. So I'll stop there.